This is The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon, a reporter in the WNYC newsroom in for Tanzina Vega all week. And we're very excited today to welcome our new listeners at WAMU in Washington, D.C., who have joined The Takeaway family of listeners. Good to have you with us.
Now, because all the work we've done, we'll have enough vaccine supply for all adults in America by the end of May. That's months ahead of schedule.
We begin this hour with a look at global vaccine distribution. More than 61 million people in the U.S. have been fully vaccinated. That's nearly 19% of the total population, according to new data from the CDC. President Joe Biden said the U.S. is ahead of many countries in terms of their vaccination rate.
Because we're actually on track to reach this goal of 100 million shots in arms on my 60th day in office. No other country in the world has done this. None.
But the outlook is far less rosy globally. High-income countries like the U.S. have purchased over half of the world's supply of vaccines, even though they make up less than a fifth of the global population. Only 84 countries currently have COVID-19 vaccines, although the WHO estimates that that'll rise to 100 in the next couple of weeks. That's led to deep disparities in vaccine distribution worldwide, which not only poses an ethical conundrum, but also creates a public health challenge. That's because if the virus is left unchecked by vaccines, high levels of spread in any country provides fertile ground for the development of new and possibly vaccine-resistant variants, which could dismantle the global progress in the fight against COVID-19. For more on this, I'm joined by Yasmin Serhan, a staff writer at The Atlantic. Yasmin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Dr. Jen Cates, the Senior Vice President and Director of Global Health and HIV Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Dr. Cates, glad to have you with us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So what is the Kaiser Family Foundation seeing in terms of vaccine access in high and low income countries?
Yes, good question. We've been looking at this for quite a while and put out a report recently to highlight the fact that there is a very big disparity, as noted in the intro, that high-income countries, including the U.S., EU, have purchased most of the doses, and very few doses available are going to low and middle-income countries, and that presents a real barrier. Right now, only about 4% of the global population has been vaccinated. And that's very far away from where we need to go, and it's hard to see how we're going to get there.
And is the disparity found across the board in terms of, you know, from vaccine supply to vaccine access to rates of vaccinations? Are the disparities there in each category?
They really are. So it starts with who's been able to purchase doses, as well as who's been able to manufacture them and access them. But once, let's say there was enough vaccines to vaccinate everybody and it was already delivered to countries, there's a whole range of other challenges around infrastructure to deliver those vaccines. As we've seen in the United States, it's not as simple as sending vaccines to a state. There has to be a delivery system. And so that's another challenge that many low and middle income countries are going to face.
And what countries or regions are you seeing the supply especially inadequate right now?
I think the big challenges are primarily in Africa, where very little vaccine has been delivered now. And we know that some of those countries have done quite amazing efforts in terms of their response to other epidemics like HIV and actually even with COVID. But still, the infrastructure there in terms of healthcare workers and facilities to manage and store vaccines are really needing a lot of attention. So in addition to having very few vaccines delivered to many countries in Africa, there's going to be an uphill battle to getting that scaled up.
Yeah, I believe NPR reported that Africa has 17% of the world population, but only 2% of the vaccine supply. Yasmin, let's bring you into this conversation. How does this compare to the rates of vaccination or even the supply here in the United States and other Western countries?
the U.S. Is in a very good position, as I'm sure many of your listeners are probably aware. Duke University has a great vaccine procurement tracker, and they found that the U.S. has reserved, I think, around 1.2 billion doses so far, which is far more than it will need to inoculate its entire population. Meanwhile, Britain is doing quite well. Britain is where I'm based currently. It's vaccinated about half of its population. It's on track to vaccinate, I think, offer a first dose to every adult by summer. The Biden administration obviously has a similar goal. Israel, I believe, is leading the world in vaccinations per capita. So the wealthy countries are doing just fine. As you mentioned, they have the lion's share of the available vaccines, and most of them have reserved more doses than they'll need.
I have to say, you are harshing my buzz, the two of you, because I was feeling pretty good about getting my first shot. But this is obviously a moral issue, but it's also a public health issue. Yasmin, you wrote about that for The Atlantic. Tell us about what the public health implications are of these disparities.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on it a bit in the beginning, but I mean, first and foremost, I think the biggest concern that we have, and we're already seeing the repercussions of it, are these new variants that are emerging. And those tend to be emerging in places where the disease, I should say, has been left just running rampant. So there was a South Africa variant, there was the Brazilian variant, there was the variant from here in the UK. So the biggest concern, I think, among public health experts is that these variants will effectively be able to escape the vaccine, and that if we see a rise in variants, that could eventually make, you know, everyone vulnerable again. This idea that we'd have a scenario of a never-ending pandemic. So it really is in the world's interest to make sure that the globe is, that countries around the world are able to vaccinate at roughly the same pace, or at least to ensure that there aren't major outbreaks anywhere. Because, you know, as you rightly noted at the beginning, if there are major outbreaks anywhere in the world, we're all vulnerable.
And I heard you correctly that you're talking indefinitely. Like, we could be living with COVID indefinitely if we do not get the whole world vaccinated.
Yeah, and at this point, it's looking like, I think the estimates I've seen is that it won't be till 2023 at the earliest before we have enough vaccines to cover the global population, which means that we really need to be working together to ensure that the most vulnerable around the world are covered, that frontline workers around the world are covered. But at the moment, you know, I don't want to harsh your excitement too much. You know, I'm really excited to see my family and friends getting vaccinated too. And, you know, I'm very much looking forward to my first jab. But, you know, there are people around the world, highly vulnerable, who need that jab more than I do. And I think we kind of, you know, need to start having a global conversation of, like, you know, how are we going to prioritize this? What is in the best interest of anyone to ensure that this, you know, this pandemic is going to last a long while? We know that coming out of this crisis is going to take some time. How do we ensure that we come out of it faster than just, you know, letting it exist anywhere and potentially threatening us all and, you know, preventing the economy from opening back up again? I mean, you know, there are public health and economic concerns here.
You know, it's upsetting, but it's not that surprising that we're seeing the same kind of health inequities that have long existed between rich and poor countries. Jen, what's been the history of pandemic response and vaccine rollouts? Has it ever been done well?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the biggest analogy that I like to make, where we've learned so much, is what's happened with the history of the HIV epidemic. Mm-hmm. And the one distinction I want to say is we don't have any vaccines for HIV, but what we do have in the HIV context are tremendously effective antiretroviral medicines. And when those first became available in the mid-1990s, very quickly it was clear that the high-income countries, the U.S., Europe, Australia, Canada, all had access, and death rates plummeted. And most of the rest of the world did not, and particularly stark was in sub-Saharan Africa. There was virtually nobody was able to access antiretrovirals. And a movement began to change that. And by early 2000s, the United States, and actually under President George W. Bush, launched PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which has resulted in providing antiretroviral therapies to millions and millions of people around the world who otherwise would not have them. And that, to me, that's a very close precedent of something that did occur. It required a lot of effort and focus and attention, but it demonstrated that it can be done. And so a lot of people today are calling attention back to that, saying we did it then. And now I think it's even more pressing because, as Yasmin was saying, the implications of this virus are different than the implications of HIV. And we're all living with this virus and at a different kind of way. And so it's you know, in everybody's interest to find a solution.
And staying with that reference to HIV and AIDS, how did that work exactly? Is it merely an infusion of U.S. funds that creates the ability to get people treatment, or is it a different kind of mechanism?
Yeah, so there were several elements that went into that I think are applicable today. There was a strong community advocacy movement to sort of push governments, the U.S. and others, to do more or to do, you know, to start to provide antiretroviral therapy. And prior to the U.S. Creating PEPFAR, there was the creation of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And so international efforts began. And those included an infusion of funding, as you mentioned, which is incredibly important, but also attention to the infrastructure and the healthcare workforce needs, as well as the supply chains. And in fact, much of that work could be built on right now for delivery of COVID vaccines. And that is what people are looking at. But the precedent is there, and I think the sort of building blocks are there as well. And the other thing it's required is sort of bringing along other global partners over time to participate. So it's not just the U.S. alone, although the U.S. continues to be the main donor to this effort.
And Jen, what do you see in terms of what kind of role President Biden or the U.S. could be playing at this point?
I think we see a very different role being played right now by the Biden administration than the Trump administration, in part because of where we are in the rollout. But the Biden administration has said it will be active in the multilateral context. It has said it's going to help find solutions. And I think it's you know, the next few months will be pretty critical. And the Biden administration has to balance the needs at home with this global concern. And I think it's going to be really hard to talk to the American people about that and explain why both are important and both need to happen at the same time.
So let's talk about COVAX. Yasmin, do you want to give start us off with that and explain that program and what it is?
Sure. Yeah. So COVAX is a multilateral initiative that's backed by the World Health Organization, and it's basically aimed at solving the problem that we've been talking about of inequitable vaccine distribution. And its goal is to provide enough vaccines to cover at least 20% of participating countries' populations, effectively to provide vaccines to ensure that all the vulnerable people and all the frontline healthcare workers in countries around the world can get the vaccines they need. And this is an initiative that the U.S. has contributed to. This is new under the Biden administration. Under Trump, the U.S. did not join COVAX and numerous other countries around the world. And the U.S. has contributed billions of dollars to that effort.
And what about Russia and China? Are they filling a gap that's been left open by Europe and the United States?
They have indeed. Yeah, I recently wrote a piece looking at this. And whilst COVAX has been doing work to make sure that there is more equitable distribution, it hasn't been able to obviously distribute a lot. It's been affected by supply issues. And as we've already established, a lot of wealthier nations have really, you know, kind of taken a lot of the vaccines for themselves and their own domestic needs, which has left a gap that Russia and China have proven all too willing to fill. They have, I believe China has produced more than 225 million doses as of the end of last month, nearly half of which they've sent abroad. And Russia has also distributed, I believe, of the 14 million doses it has produced, 31% of which they've exported elsewhere. And they've been targeting countries around the world across Asia, Latin America, Africa. And the way a lot of Western leaders see it, they're effectively trying to really kind of bolster their own image, using their vaccines as sort of soft power, so to speak. They've been really kind of stepping in. And you see it even in wealthy countries like the UAE. The UAE is like Israel and the U.S. has vaccinated large swathes of its population, and it's largely done so, I believe, using Chinese vaccines.
And there must be just grave geopolitical implications, if not hazards, ahead given this restricted supply of vaccine. I mean, could this become the new oil? Could we be seeing, in worst case scenario, wars break out over vaccine distribution?
Gosh, I mean, I hope not. I think the way to understand this is that, obviously there are geopolitical concerns, and I think we've heard leaders talk about them. But, when it comes to a public health crisis, it really is in everyone's interests to ensure that vaccines are getting where they need to go. And in this respect, I've spoken to people who have really kind of criticized the politicization of these vaccines. Like, we're at a moment where, these vaccines are saving lives. And, if we aim to politicize them, it can cause a lot of problems. And I think crucial for a lot of U.S. and European leaders is that they may speak about, I think, leveled plenty of legitimate criticisms against Russia and China's vaccination distribution efforts. Their aggressive sales tactics, their lack of transparency when it comes to efficacy data, their efforts to undermine trust in other vaccines. But, Western countries haven't really offered a lot of the receiving countries, many of which have scarcely begun their vaccination rollouts, any alternative. So as long as wealthy countries like the U.S., like Britain, are focusing on their own domestic needs, which, given how battered both countries have been by the pandemic, is understandable to an extent, they're really not in a position to tell other countries, look, you shouldn't take these vaccines because geopolitically it's bad for us. So I think it's really complicated, but I think, vaccines are unlike oil or any other sort of commodity that we would typically fight about. These are, products that save lives. And if they're safe and effective, we should hope that world leaders will work together to ensure that they get where they need to go.
So let's talk about pharmaceutical companies and manufacturers. Jen, what can you tell us about what their role has been and what they've done about vaccine inequity that we're seeing?
Yes, I think the big picture, as we've seen in many other cases, there's a few manufacturers right now that have come out with successful products, particularly that were for use in the U.S. and several other countries. China and Russia have also developed their products. But in general, there's a good story here and then maybe a more challenging one. The good story is that the pharmaceutical industry really did rally quite quickly and in fact worked together in some ways that don't usually happen to massively speed up with help of government regulators and others, the process to get effective, safe vaccines into many countries and into the arms of millions of people now. And that is quite an amazing accomplishment, and one we should look back on and try to understand what was able to be done that we can learn from for future efforts, emergency or otherwise. On the other hand, there is a debate and a challenge going on about what should their role be in terms of easing up on patent protections and other regulatory mechanisms that allow pharmaceutical industries to enjoy protection for their products. Again, going back to HIV, this was a big battle in the HIV context, and there's going to be a tension, I think, between the pharmaceutical industry coming forward and sort of voluntarily making its technology available and making its products available on the one hand versus being, forced a little bit to do so. And that's a discussion that's happening at the WTO, and the US and some other countries are not supportive of easing up on those patents. So I think the issue of what happens with the pharmaceutical industry and how governments approach this is going to be one to look for the next several months to over the next few years. And it could have some pretty significant implications.
Dr. Jen Cates is the Senior Vice President and Director of Global Health and HIV Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And Yasmeen Serhan is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nancy Solomon, in for Tanzina Vega this week. In March, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform held a hearing in consideration of a bill that would make Washington, D.C. a state.
I am Muriel Bowser. I am mayor of Washington, D.C., and I'm honored to come before this committee to ask this Congress to right the wrong that happened 220 years ago when the residents of the District of Columbia were stripped of their full congressional representation.
The city's more than 700,000 residents pay more in federal taxes than 22 states, but have just one non-voting member of Congress and no senators. Events over the past year have brought the long-standing burden to a head. When Trump supporters violently descended on the Capitol in order to disrupt Congress's final tally on the general election in January, D.C. officials couldn't call in the National Guard. And D.C. officials have had trouble lobbying the federal government for an adequate number of vaccine doses. Many of the district's residents are frustrated by their city's territory status.
Renee Davis, Southeast D.C., Ward 7.
I'm Yvette Bayash, and I'm from Washington, D.C.
My name is James Lewis, and I've lived here 50 years.
My name's Marlon. I'm from Wharton, Virginia, which isn't too far from D.C.
Our producer, Patricia Jacob, asked these folks if D.C. should be a state.
Taxation without representation makes absolutely no sense. D.C. should have a voice. Can we have some representation? For me, that's everything. We can't even call in our own National Guard if there is an emergency. We have to get permission from someone else. That makes absolutely no sense in 2021.
We pay a lot and we put into this city, and it really kind of sucks that our vote doesn't count or our voice doesn't matter. I think we would just gain a bigger voice, you know, because I know moving to this city 25 years ago, a lot of people here didn't vote because a lot of people here feel that their vote doesn't count because we have no representation, because we're not a state. And I think that's disheartening. And I think becoming a statehood would encourage people even more to, you know, that their voice matters.
I think the District of Columbia should be made into a state because it gives the residents more voice. Gives us a vote in Congress, and I think we can accomplish a lot more with it being a state. It's taxation without proper representation. With becoming a state, I think we would feel more empowered.
So D.C. should become a state. I think it has a population higher than two other states. It also, being an independent entity, would allow it, you know, state rights such as an ability to have votes in Congress and things like that. I think being dependent on the federal government to provide services and things isn't appropriate for a place that has almost 1 million people living in it. You know, on a pre-COVID, any given day would have 1.5 million people working, commuting, things like that. So representation at a federal level, I think, is, as we can see, is crucial to, you know, how democracy plays out. You know, as a citizen in a country that lives in, D.C., you know, your vote doesn't necessarily matter at a federal level, such as, you know, Virginia or Maryland that we're bordered by. To a degree, violates the civil rights of those people who decide to live and make residency in D.C.
D.C. statehood is also an issue that's galvanizing young activists in the district.
I'm Ty Hobson Powell, 25 years old, and I'm a lead organizer with 51 for 51.
51 for 51 is a national coalition of progressive groups that advocates for D.C. statehood.
It is morally the right thing to do. You know, we have over 710,000 residents, majority black and brown, who pay the highest federal taxes in the nation, who have all of the obligations as Americans, but none of the same rights as it pertains to being empowered in democracy. We send men and women off to serve. We have people that serve on juries. You know, we do our part as Americans, only then to be left out of the promise of the American dream.
Ty says that the issue of D.C. statehood goes deeper than the no taxation without representation slogan.
This is also a racial equity issue. We were shorted hundreds of millions of dollars for the CARES Act, which provides relief for coronavirus to the states because we weren't designated as a state. Now, in our fight with COVID here in Washington, D.C., Black and brown populations have been the most disproportionately affected by the plague of COVID-19. Go on, you look at gun violence, because people don't often equate the fight for D.C. statehood with the fight for safer streets, but it is, because D.C. on the books has some of the most progressive gun violence prevention laws in the nation. But that means nothing when we don't have a seat at the table to speak to issues like red flag laws and background checks about the guns that are coming from other states with lax regulations that are wreaking havoc in the streets of Washington, D.C., and disproportionately affecting mainly Black and brown youth.
And Ty also believes that some of the opposition to making D.C. a state is rooted in misconceptions about who really lives in the district.
A lot of why D.C. hasn't been a state is racism, but a large part of that, I believe, is ignorance, that people have no idea about what's going on here in Washington, D.C. And we saw that in our work with 5151. We would travel to Iowa, to New Hampshire, to South Carolina, and really just be able to humanize the fact that there are Washingtonians that live here outside of the politicians that occupy the Hill.
We just heard how D.C. residents are feeling about the possibility of statehood for the district, and some of the loudest voices calling for D.C. to become a state are local politicians. Janice Lewis-George represents Ward 4 on the City Council, and she joins me now. Councilmember George, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Nancy.
You know, before we jump into the conversation about statehood, I was so sorry to see the news Friday about the incident at the Capitol where a person drove a car into two Capitol police officers, killing one of them and injuring the other. What kind of impact is the January 6th riot and last week's violence having on the city?
First, I share our condolences to the family of Officer Billy Evans on their tragic loss, and I hope the other officer who was struck can make a full recovery. This was just the latest tragic example of the catastrophic impact that, you know, right-wing extremism has had on our country and on our safety. And D.C. has been in dialogue with Congress over what security should look like at the U.S. Capitol and the White House. And there needs to be a balance struck there. You know, on one hand, it's important we take measures to prevent and protect against, you know, future attacks. But we also can't build and shut down the People's House in our Capitol building from ordinary people. D.C. is already over police because we have so many law enforcement agencies operating, from DC police to transit police to secret services, federal agents, and so many more. And so, you know, we need to be smart about how we protect the district and not just adopt any measures for the sake of security theater.
What do you see as the clearest argument in favor of making DC a state?
The best reason for statehood is what is written on our license plates here in the district. We need to end taxation without representation. It is our birthright. There are 700,000 residents who do not have U.S. senators to represent them and who do not have representation in Congress that gets to vote in their interests. And that's just fundamentally undemocratic and unjust. And it's such a huge disadvantage compared to other states, including states like Wyoming and Vermont, who have fewer residents than D.C. And we also pay more than 22 other states in federal taxes. And so this is absolutely a modern day civil rights violation. And that's the clearest argument. It's not democratic. It doesn't speak to our values as a country. And it's absolutely our birthright.
46% of the city's residents are Black. What has been the conversation about race so far when it comes to statehood?
Absolutely. You know, we view DC statehood as a racial justice issue. And I think the denial of statehood for over DC for over the decades is closely connected to the reality that nearly half of all DC residents are Black. And historically, it has been much higher than that. And if admitted, DC would have the greatest percentage of Black Americans of any state in the Union. And even when we look back in history, when Virginia took back its land, that had roots in their ability to be able to continue to have, you know, practices with Black Americans here in this country. And the other piece of that we talk about is not just, you know, Black Americans in this country, but Indigenous people. Another side of state DC statehood that many people often neglect is that DC is also home to Indigenous people, Native Americans that inhabit this land well before any of us. And so to this day, the Piscataway people live in DC, but are denied any representation in the US government as well. And when you account for the fact that our federal buildings are actually built on Piscataway land, the denial of statehood for those residents is even more unacceptable.
You've also framed DC statehood as a criminal justice issue. Explain how that factors in here.
Absolutely. Especially as a former assistant attorney general, DC's lack of statehood impacts our city, how our city is run. And DC has one of the highest rates of mass incarceration in the country. And that's largely because the federal government controls many parts of our criminal justice system, including prosecuting DC residents, deciding when DC residents get probation, our parole system, our laws on marijuana, and many more. And so these are unelected federal officials who aren't accountable to our communities, deciding in many cases to lock up our residents and throw away the key. And that's not the criminal justice approach that we believe in, but it's what's forced on us as a result of our lack of statehood.
So what about the Republican argument that the push is an attempt by the left to tip the Senate in their favor because DC voters overwhelmingly vote for Democrats? How do you respond to that criticism?
You know, I just think it's fundamentally unfair. You know, our representation should not be based on partisan issues. That really is the gist of it. And to make that argument is completely undemocratic. You know, it's undemocratic, and it doesn't speak to what we believe in, no matter what state you live in this country, that this is what our forefathers imagined, you know, for this country. And some of the biggest, you know, fights in this country have been over, you know, taxation without representation. So I fundamentally believe our representation shouldn't be based on partisan issues. And there's really no political litmus test for joining the union as a state, or absolutely shouldn't be a litmus test for joining the union as a state.
Have there been any other arguments against it made?
You know, I think other arguments that we've seen come up regarding DC statehood is also the argument that somehow we would have the district residents would have some type of undue influence on Congress, and we should be a neutral body. But what I think most people don't understand is that the way our current H.R. 51 legislation is written is that there would be a capital enclave that surrounds the capital area. And so there, that still would be neutral land and neutral area. And then the outside portions where district residents like myself and 700,000 other district residents live would be considered a part of that. And so to say that somehow we would have an undue influence because of our position at the Capitol level, it doesn't make any logical sense at all.
House Republicans have also said that if DC residents want representation in Congress, they could be incorporated into Maryland instead of becoming their own separate state. Would that address the issues at the center of this fight?
No, that's not a viable alternative. And DC residents are not interested in that. Maryland residents are not interested in that either. And, you know, we know that from our strong support from congressmen like Jamie Raskins, who's talked about that before. It's just not a viable alternative for DC residents.
And why is that? Can you explain why that wouldn't work?
You know, this the history of DC and our community and what we've grown here to say, hey, well, let's, you know, have DC go back into Maryland. We have our own local government, our own communities, our own laws, and our own culture at the same time, to be able to lead in that way. The other piece of that is, you know, I heard some people making that argument, and I said, well, okay, great. Well, why do the same people making this argument, you can tell where their animus lies, because I say, oh, well, let's let West Virginia go back into Virginia. Let South Dakota, North Dakota become one state. And those same individuals who are making this argument are up in arms about it. And so that's how you understand that there is, that's where you start to see the animus behind it and sort of the partisan issues come to play and the racial justice issues come to play when we start asking for other states to merge into one another and they get up in arms. Those senators and congressmen specifically were very upset about the idea when we brought that back to them.
That's interesting. So the bill to make D.C. a state would need 60 votes to surpass a Senate filibuster. That's unlikely due to the 50-50 split in the Senate. But there are talks that statehood could be added to H.R. 1. That's the voting rights reform bill. Is that something that you and your colleagues on the council have talked about? Do you think that's a viable political path?
Yes, so I do. I think that's we've talked about it. And, you know, I think it's right. D.C. statehood is absolutely a voting rights issue. And should be included in H.R. 1. And I do think that that's a viable path forward for D.C. statehood. And we're excited to see so much energy in Congress behind it. I think this year especially has really shed a light on D.C. statehood in a way that it hasn't been previously. We've been front and center, whether it's, you know, because of what we happened at the Capitol, where our law enforcement stepped up to the plate to help save our country, or because we were denied our funding under the CARES Act by being a territory during COVID, and also being at the center of the Black Lives Matter protest as a city that has a huge number of Black residents, and we talk about where we are as a country, and we have a large number of Black residents who have been denied elected representation. So I think this is the best time for us to discuss this when we talk about wanting to right the wrongs of our history.
We had been talking earlier in the show about the inequities of vaccine distribution, and I'm wondering if the lack of statehood in Washington, D.C. has affected the ability of the city to get its share of vaccine doses.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. You know, I believe D.C.'s lack of statehood has affected our vaccine distribution, which affects our ability to protect the health of D.C. residents. Earlier in the pandemic, we were treated as a U.S. territory, and we were denied our fair share of federal assistance from the CARES Act to help keep our residents safe. And then when vaccines began being distributed, we weren't even given enough vaccines for our healthcare workers. And then when D.C., Maryland, and Virginia asked the federal government to vaccinate essential federal workers who live in our region, they denied the request. And then finally, D.C. was also recently denied a mass vaccination site despite having vulnerable populations based on a flawed metric from the federal government. So these aren't just inconveniences. You know, our lack of statehood is jeopardizing D.C.'s ability to save the lives of its residents through vaccines. Mm.
Janice Lewis-George is a council member for Ward 4 in Washington, D.C. Councilmember George, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Nancy. And I will say, as a native Washingtonian, I am committed, as our mayor says, I was born without representation, but I will not die without it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Last month, one of the most successful singer-songwriters in Latin America won her second Grammy Award. That's Natalia Lafourcade. The Mexican singer won her Grammy Award for her album Un Canto por México, Volume 1. In 2017, a devastating earthquake struck Mexico, killing thousands and destroying many areas in southern Mexico. In the state of Veracruz, where Natalia's from, a cultural center aimed at preserving Son Jarocho, a regional folk musical style from the state, was badly damaged. So in 2019, Natalia gathered other musicians and organized a benefit concert to help raise funds for the center. This album, based on that 2019 concert, features traditional Mexican musical styles, including mariachi, son huasteco, and many others. And joining us now to talk about her Grammy win and the album is Natalia Lafourcade. Natalia, what a treat to have you on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So huge congratulations on the Grammy win and the 3 Latin Grammy Awards as well. What a year for you. That must feel pretty good.
Yeah, especially in a project like this where there's so many people involved and there's so many energy and magic and spirit put into this music, you know? So we are very proud and very happy that this is going this way.
Yeah, and not to mention you released the album during a global pandemic. What were the challenges there with that?
Yeah, especially in these moments. And also the spirit of the project, you know, it's been a whole journey. So many people involved so far. I mean, the musicians, but also the organizations and all the people that are working in order to build this important place for music and in Jaltipan and the musicians in this album. I feel so fortunate, you know, because there is people so talented people there, and I feel very proud to be part of this beautiful and magic project.
Well, let's play a clip from the album. This is the song Mi Tierra Veracruzana.
Volverte a ver, volverte a ver. Mi tierra veracruzana, te quiero ver. Volverte a ver, volverte a ver. Mi tierra veracruzana, te quiero querer.
So this song is about the state you grew up in, Veracruz. It's not typically what one hears on the pop charts, either in terms of the lyrics or the style. So tell us about the song.
Well, I was working on this. Many of the songs of these 2 volumes of music is part of the music that I recorded some time ago for 2 other albums that are called Musas. It's a homage to the Latin American folklore latinoamericano. So I wanted to write a song that would be about the place where I grew up, the place that I love and that most inspiration gives me, which is one of the place, right? Which is my home, which is Veracruz, and which is Coatepec, which is this little town that I love and where I live in. Yeah, so I wanted to put that color and that emotion that it gives me, right? Like in the lyrics, like I wanted to talk about the food, the people, the colors, the landscapes, the flavors. I don't know. I wanted to put all that Mexican thing into the song. So I remember that I was trying to write this song for months, and then I was in the suite in Los Cabos because I was having a show there. And I remember that I stayed for the weekend and I said, okay, I'm not gonna go out from the room until I finish the song. Oh, because wow. I had it in my mind, you know, I had it like kind of a melody and then the idea of what I wanted to say. But I was just really not finding the way to put it, so on the paper and the music. So I said, like, okay, I'm not going out, because we were gonna go into the studio for recording the album, to record the album like soon, by the time. So I was like, okay, I better finish this one because I really want to sing to my town and Veracruz. So I stayed there for like 3 days. Down, like, and I ended up writing 3 of the most important songs for the album, which was Tú Si Sabes Quererme, which is another one that is going to be in the 2nd volume, and Mi Tierra Veracruzana, and I don't remember the other one, but it was a very beautiful, productive and weekend.
Well, you've been called a guardian of Mexican culture. Are you comfortable with that description? And what is it that you're trying to do?
Guardian. Yeah. Well, it feels pretty if they say that. It's a lot of responsibility as well, if they put it that way. I'd like to say that I love this music and I love playing around with the folklore and this traditional music. I don't know if I'm gonna be in this place forever, you know, because I am very curious as a musician, as a writer, as a singer, interpreter also as well. So I don't know, but I love doing this music and I love it because it makes me feel so strong, you know, because it's the type of music we have here is our culture, is our story, is the genres of the folklore. And I mean, we have so many. So it's so interesting for me. I've been learning so much. And since I work with this music, I feel like better human, better musician, better person. So I don't know. I just love it. I just love sharing a lot this music. It has such a great spirit and makes people so happy.
You started your career as a pop star. So here's one of your first hits from 2002 called NL 2000. Pero el planeta gira, gira a la derecha. Cada vez que la noche es más tibia, sin amor se enfría. No tengo nombre ni ayer y así me siento tan vacía. A ver, a ver, ¿qué pasa en el siguiente día? So that's quite different from the traditional Mexican music that you're currently performing. How did you come to the traditional stuff?
It's been a very, very long journey for me. I think there was a moment in my career, probably in the third album, which was called Hu Hu Hu. There was a very special and interesting moment for my career where it felt like everything was out of its place, but I was exploring and trying to find a way of do it and make it my own way, you know? And I traveled to Canada and I was trying to step away from my country, my people, my family, my friends, my career, trying to find my own way, because I was, before I felt like I was doing what others wanted me to do, you know? So then I came back to Mexico trying to reconnect with Mexico and my audience. And I realized that I needed to put out a record, right? And I didn't have enough music and I didn't have the right music. I was like, okay, I still need to learn how to write a very, very good song. So I said, I'm gonna work with Agustín Lara's music, which is a very important composer from Mexico, from Veracruz as well. I discovered his music and I was just super like impressed and motivated about like working with his music. So that was a very, very first step to try this new world, you know? And it was so good for me because I discovered like the singers from my country that are like that Etta James or Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday that I really admire and I was listening. But I was like, I don't know if we have this in Mexico. But then thanks to Agustín Lara, I discovered Tonya La Negra's voice, which is one of my favorite singers. So I was like, wow, this music is like the bolero, is like a jazz, like in Spanish. It's like that incredible standard, but in Spanish. So I just like said, like, I need to turn my head and find and know the music that was made in my country like before and try to learn from the masters like in Latin America and also Mexico. So my attention went to another direction and I ended up like, yeah, listening to the music that is part of the place where I grew up, which is San Jarocho, and which is este ranchero and bolero and cumbia. And I just, yeah, ended up like trying those changes and those flavors into my music and see what happened, you know, and making that a very strong influence for me, so I could have this taste and this essence in my music, and I was dreaming people from other countries like to listen to my music and say, oh, this is a Mexican lady. that style and that music and that all different things, not just the music, you know, like the influence about the culture would be impressed into my music, so it would be printed into my music.
You mm-hmm. recently released a single, El Focina y El Mar. It's a song from the 60s, first made famous by Argentine singer Mercedes Sosa.
Antigua de viento y de sal que requiebra el alma y le está llevando.
It's such a beautiful but sad song. What motivated you to want to cover that one in particular?
I mean, that song, it's been in my life since I was very little. My father would play that one on the piano. And I remember for a long time trying to sing that song, you know, like trying to put it in my voice. And it was very difficult for me. I don't know why. Well, it's a very difficult one. But yeah, the spirit and the pain and the story behind the song, it's so strong that I don't know. I wasn't able to do it. And this year I took my guitar and I was trying to find a way of singing that melody, and I could do it finally. I was like, okay, I finally can sing it, because yeah, for a long time it was hard for me. So yeah, I wanted to put it out just as a collaboration also with Noah Jorson and Lev Lovia, and some friends in the States that were helping me with the recording and the production of the song in the distance, you know. So I just wanted to put this one as a commemoration of the women for the month of March, and also the video, which is a video where I am playing around with a discipline that I love, which is dancing. And I was dancing for the sea and for the waves and for trying to make this connection with Earth, you know, especially this year and last year for me, the connection with this place, which is this beautiful beach where we went to for making the video. It's one of my favorite places in the world, you know. I feel so safe there. So during the pandemic here last year, I was going to this place, and I was dancing there. I was just moving my body and playing and making improvisation with my body there, and the waves and the sea. And there was a moment I felt like I was having a very strong connection to it, you know, as if we were having a conversation by moving our bodies. I mean, like, I talk about my body, but also like Earth's mother body, Mother Earth's mother body, right? So it felt so magic for me. And there was a day where my husband and my friends were coming with us. So I asked them to hold the phone and make a video of me making this improvisation with the sea and the nature, and they did it. And then we just found that it was very pretty to put that experiment with the song on top. So that's how we finally made the video. So I don't know, I just wanted to share that as a inspiration for women to be free and to dance and to hoping that this could be a way of living for us in a short future, you know, when we can arrange all these different problems and matters that we're going through, but to finally get this liberty and this freedom and this happiness and this connection to our to ourselves and souls, you know.
Well, you've also been outspoken about the systemic killing of women. In 2020, there were nearly 1,000 women who were victims of femicide, which is the killing of women because of their gender. What are your thoughts on the recent protests about the murders?
Well, I believe that there's a very strong work that we must do together. I believe that it's very important to see how these people are working, because it makes you stop a minute to think about what's happening, right? I think that since like a certain like time ago, like we're finally like making this question and debate, like I don't know how you say that word, but we're starting this conversation on the table, you know, about what's happening in our world and what can we do to change it. And it's a work we must do, and hopefully we can find a way to arrange all this violence to women, but also like to human beings in this world, you know, because mm-hmm. it goes beyond that. It goes to the point that we should, yeah, see each other and find the respect of life that we must keep for all the time. You know, it's about education. It's about how we grew up. Like, what are we learning since we're children in our houses, you know? Like, I think there's so many people in the world that are sick, but in the spirit are very, very deep ill, you know? Like, this must be fixed, and we must work together as well to fix it, trying like to work in our spaces, in our places, like every, even though it's a very little thing that we can work inside ourselves to help each other, to see like one woman seeing another woman and saying like, okay, I'm gonna give you my hand. I'm doing better than you, but I can help you out. Like, I can make something for you. Like, I don't know, I think it's a very important moment and very special to see how much work it's been done nowadays. And it gives you faith, you know, to see that things could change. And I believe that things could change. And I try mm-hmm. to do and be a part of it by making music that will inspire others and that will put them in this frequency of love, which I think it's so important to keep every day.
Just one of the higher profile killings was a woman named Victoria, a Salvadoran migrant who was detained and killed by Mexican police in Tulum. That's raising the issue of the Central American migrant crisis there. How's the government been responding since that happened?
Well, people complain because there's so many women that have been declaring is that how you say?
Uh-huh.
the violence or the murder or
decrying the violence, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And at the very, very end, that they don't do nothing about it. It seems that they don't do nothing about it because it keeps happening, you know? So it's a very delicate thing. It's a very delicate problem. And it must, as I said, it must be fixed. It must be, they must find the solution for this. Yeah, it's very sad. And that's probably one of the things that makes me sad about the things that happened in Mexico for me, because it's so unfair at the end. Like, it shouldn't be that way.
Thank you so much. Natalia Lafourcade is a Grammy Award-winning Mexican singer and songwriter. Natalia, thanks so much for your time. It was great to talk to you.
No, thank you. Thank you, too. Thank you for having me. I hope people can listen to this music, and this music makes them happy, just as happy as it makes me. And thank you for the interview.
Desde que vi tus ojos me enamoré, me enamoré, me enamoré. Desde que oí tu canto sabía que no había manera de abandonarte, mi amor.
All right, everyone, good to have you with me on my first day in the takeaway chair. Tanzina will be back with you soon. I'm with you this whole week, and today was a good start. We want to welcome our new friends in Washington, D.C. today, WAMU listeners. We're very thrilled to have you be part of our day in the Beltway. Welcome to the club. A lot of our audience already knows this, but you can always reach us and leave a comment or take. We have a few ways to do that. One, you can email a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com, or you can call us and leave a message at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. And the show is at The Takeaway on Twitter, if that's more your style. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Nancy Solomon, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
En tu primer abrazo recuerdo que mi cuerpo vivo y temblorosa mi voz, porque todo en este universo cobró razón, en mi existir eres tú.